thousand million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
There's a few things I've been studying recently that have been very moving and affecting my life in some way just by reading them, which is wonderful when Dharma, and some of it's not even really Dharma per se, wonderful when things can do that to us, huh? You know, move us and have some experiential effect. And they're kind of, these are in the realm of the very practical, not so much in the realm of the subtle mind of Zazen, although related. The practice of precepts, as you may have heard in our tradition, is they say precepts are virtue or ethical conduct, and Zen are not two different realms. That mind of letting go and receiving our function moment to moment is the mind that lives in accord with all beings in the conventional world. And also it's this time of the year, right? The season of giving. And so it's in the air, and there's a different feeling, I think, around giving this time of year, Christmas and all, and there's the Salvation Army people out on the sidewalk and so on. We have this barrel that's amazingly filling up quite high outside the door of food for homeless and so on. So all of this coming together, first of all, to bring up the what we call in our tradition the three collective pure precepts. And I thought maybe even, as the new year begins, explore, at least in some talks, the Bodhisattva precepts of our school. And often it's emphasized that the ten Bodhisattva precepts are maybe more talked about and emphasized compared to these three collective pure precepts are kind of like a summary of the ten sometimes. But one of the things I've been looking at is an inspiring source of these three pure precepts, which where the precepts are, as you may have heard, different translations, but I think maybe we say here in our monthly ceremony something like embracing and sustaining right conduct. Is that how we say? Embracing and sustaining all good, and embracing and sustaining all beings. These are the three pure precepts. And they're sometimes associated, and some other Zen groups, use this version, which isn't really the version, the Zen version, but because they're associated with these other three. Sometimes people use these maybe because they're easier to understand. I'm not sure why. But we, some groups say avoid all evil or refrain from all evil, do all good, and benefit all beings, something like that. But the source for how they're worded in our tradition seems to come from this kind of obscure Mahayana sutra called the Jewel Necklace Sutra, which has not been translated into English. But maybe more commonly presented or more well-known source is the great Indian Bodhisattva Asanga, who is the founder of the Yogacara school in India, the mind-only school. He expounded on these three pure precepts, and that was the content of Mahayana Bodhisattva ethics, according to Asanga. And maybe he based them on this sutra, although I don't think he quotes it by name. And the version that Asanga uses is the same one that has come down to us in Chinese and Japanese through Dogen Zenji in Japan. The first one is embracing and sustaining right conduct, or I like to translate it as embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, because it's particularly referring to these conventional, agreed-upon standards. And embracing and sustaining, that's used in all three, is this word show, in this case, also can be pronounced setsu, and it's the same character that we use for seshin, which is abbreviated for setsu shin, and that setsu means gather together. So seshin is we call gathering the mind, collecting the mind or the heart together. So it means gathering or embracing and sustaining, bringing together. So it's an interesting term, because it has these multiple layers of meaning. But in this case, it's embracing, sustaining, gathering standards of conduct in Japanese, ritsugi, which is a Japanese way of saying vinaya, like manners or deportment, we could even say. Ritsugi is like vinaya. Vinaya is a Indian Sanskrit word that means like the monastic regulations and modes of conduct like this. Gi is like, could be ceremony or manners, ways of doing things. So it's the and it refers to in this in Asanga, in his long commentary, which we do have in English, which is what I've been looking at recently. He clarifies what these three are, and he's saying this one, gathering or embracing and sustaining these standards of conduct or vinaya, precepts or manners, is like is the traditional monastic precepts, monastic and non-monastic, from the time of Buddha, before the birth of the Mahayana. They're like all the many standards and regulations for monastics that set up these different categories of practitioners. So lay people and novice monks and nuns, and then full monastics have, you know, in the conventional world, the Buddha set up these kind of standards or ways of, they're kind of like lifestyle setups for how to live in these different categories. And some of them are, you know, applied to Indian culture, but they're still followed by practitioners all over the world today. And so he just says, this is the kind of like conventional world thing. This is like, we're not going to do away with these conventions that are just, you know, customary things in old India or whatever. We'll follow that way of the conventional world, and we'll say these people are like this and these are like this, and even if they're not Mahayana bodhisattvas, they still would receive one of these versions of precepts. That's the kind of proposal of a Sangha. And so he doesn't talk about it much. He just says, you know, you can go to those precept texts to see what those are. And then the next one, the next two are like the particularly Mahayana Bodhisattva versions. But, you know, we could talk more about the monastic precepts and the early lay precepts and the difference between them and what was being done there at some point. I think that's a big topic, and it's been an interesting thing for me to contemplate over the years of what does that mean for us in America now? Because we're so far in so many ways from the original monastic precepts of India and even China and Tibet and so on, where they still keep these precepts. And there was a time when I actually, for maybe 3 years or so, I tried to follow all of these Vinaya precepts for Bhikshu precepts for a fully ordained monastic, even though I wasn't. I said, let's check this out. Let's see what this lifestyle, how it works. And my memories of those years is a very warm-hearted memory, actually, of a very beautiful life, sometimes difficult and very inconvenient in many ways. But that basically what I learned, in brief, was that it simplified my life a lot. Basically, I didn't do much of anything but meditate and study Dharma and, you know, walk around when I could. It was very simple. And also, I think in the early teachings, they say, well, what's the purpose of precepts before the Mahayana, they say? Because I think a Sangha and the Mahayana would have a different take on the purpose or function. But in those early teachings, they say the purpose of Sila or precepts or virtue is non-remorse. Which is interesting, I think, because I think that was a lot of the effect, even though I still had some remorse and, you know, shame about my conduct or regret maybe about my conduct. I think that was a time in my life where it was like at the most minimal. And you could say, well, shouldn't we actually have, isn't it good to like always have some sense of, maybe shame isn't quite the right word, but humility maybe, or you know, at least noticing our faults and so we can let go of them and not harm others. And I think that's true too, that we don't want to deny anything, but it seems like the point is that if we're really living as harmlessly as possible in the conventional world, that this sense of like not regretting very much, regretting like, oh, even whether it's harming others or whether it's one's own conduct, like, oh, I just feel like a little ashamed that I didn't like need that extra thing or to do that extra activity or whatever. And there's just like, and there's this great joy from non-remorse. And that's what the Buddha says. So it's like, it's for the function of, in a way, personal joy, the joy of living blamelessly and shamelessly in the world. This is how the Buddha talks about it in the early sutras. And I feel like I had some experience of that. It's not quite the same, you know, not living so in such a narrow bamboo tube. But the next two Bodhisattva precepts are particularly the path of the Bodhisattva. So they're not so much about like the personal joy of the practitioner. They're more, in a way they are, but it's instead of finding the joy through personal purity, it's like finding the joy through giving your life to others is really what it's about. So I think they're like, even though there's a lot of overlap between all three of these, the joy is coming from a different place. I would say a wider, more open place. So the second one is embracing and sustaining Hozen Kai. So Zenbo. So good or wholesome dharmas, gathering good dharmas, Kushala Dharma Sangraha. Precept. So it's like gathering together or collecting good dharmas. We say all good, but it's particularly like, you know, dharmas are mental factors of mind. So it's like wholesome factors of mind. And so Asanga starts, this is where he starts getting into these all these lists of practices that are, I think, really beautiful. And so he says, some of them are just like not necessarily helping others. That's really what the third one is more about this. But some are about benefiting others, but also it's like listening to, contemplating, and practicing the teachings. So, you know, that could be a personal kind of practice, but it's not so much like refraining from harmful activity. It's more like doing some positive practice and practicing shamatha and vipassana, practicing meditation, being respectful toward teachers, praising the good actions of others by saying, well done, he actually says, generating a genuine joy in the merits of others, practicing patience with others' faults, dedicating the merit of any good we do to the awakening of all beings, making extensive offerings to the Buddha and the three treasures, and confessing and repenting our harmful actions. So this is like a kind of summarized list. Asanga goes on for pages, you know, extolling the virtues of these all these wonderful bodhisattva practices, embracing and sustaining all good dharmas, wholesome qualities of mind. And then the third is embracing and sustaining living beings, sentient beings, and that's actually things like caring for the sick and protecting beings from harm and providing requisites to people in need and these types of things. This is really has to do with others now, helping others, and giving dharma as well as material things, and also complying with worldly convention. I thought it was an interesting one that he mentions. And he says, for example, like responding when you're called, instead of just like, I'm just like a yogi, so I'm like in samadhi and I'm not gonna, you know, move. It's more like you just go along with the way the world goes, which it might be a little bit, maybe in these some of these Vinaya precepts from the early Buddhism, it's so contrary to the way the world works that it might contradict this precept sometimes. You know, because it's kind of like not going along with worldly conventions, a lot of it. And so greeting others on the street and saying hello and so on, and encouraging others to confess their harmful actions, and, you know, gently and only for the sake of benefiting them. So these kinds of things. So this one makes me think of, this is the, like the holiday giving time one. Literally, you know, caring for those in need and protecting people from harm and providing the requisites of, you know, food, shelter, medicine, and clothing to those in need. And So this is Bodhisattva precept. This is, you know, the commentary of gathering or embracing and sustaining all living beings. And this brings me to this other book that I've been looking at that's having this surprising effect on me, because it's by a philosopher, an ethics philosopher, Peter Singer. Does anyone know him? He's maybe most well known for this book called Animal Liberation, maybe like 20 years ago or so, which was also, I think, very powerful book that had a big effect on me, where he basically, through pure philosophy but very, very clear reasoning, he kind of proves that, like, basically, that as a world, or our society anyway, it's like, there's this widespread, he calls speciesism, you know, and like by bringing out various interesting examples of how, like, you know, we love our dog, but we'll eat a cow, we'll support the killing and eating of a cow, and like that philosophically or ethically that makes no sense at all, you know, but like it's totally normal, it's completely normal. And also even comparing animals to humans, and like would we put humans so high above animals, you know, in terms of worth, and that the philosophical basis for not causing harm is quite ungrounded, because I think he makes the point there that it's about the suffering, it's about not causing suffering is the main reason to not cause harm, and it's like whether the intelligence of a living being should not be the basis for harm or not harm. Because then he's like, you don't, if there's a mentally retarded human, you don't treat them any ethically less valuable than an intelligent human. So it's very interesting arguments that I don't want to get into that one now, but he's got a new book called The Life You Can Save, and this one's about ending world poverty amongst humans, and also some very interesting reasonings, I think, in here. So there's a few of these stories. This is all under the heading of embracing and sustaining living beings. So these are like, you know, stories to make us like think about how our reasoning is kind of skewed, and you know, it's quite convincing to me in a somewhat frightening way. So here's one story he tells, like just an example. On your way to work, you pass a small pond. On hot days, children sometimes play in the pond, which is only about knee deep. The weather's cool today, though, and the hour's early, so you're surprised to see a child splashing about in the pond. As you get closer, you see that it's a very young child, just a toddler, who's flailing about, unable to stay upright or walk out of the pond. You look for the parents or babysitter, but there's no one else around. The child is unable to keep his head above the water for more than a few seconds at a time. If you don't wade in and pull him out, he seems likely to drown. Wading in is easy and safe, but you will ruin the new shoes you bought only a few days ago and get your suit wet and muddy. And by the time you hand the child over to someone responsible for him and change your clothes, you'll be late for work. What should you do? And he says, you know, he brings up these examples in his ethics classes and takes these polls and so on. And he says, well, virtually everyone would say, well, of course, get your shoes wet and go in and save the kid, right? It's like not even a question. It's okay to be late for work. You're like saving a human life. So then he's saying, he's like equating that to this situation in the world where there's, you know, without getting caught up in too many of these figures and stuff, there's something like, you know, 27,000 children die every day, I think it is. Die every day, or more than 1,000 every hour, from causes that could be very easily prevented. You know, for like a few cents, for like a measles vaccination or diarrhea medicine. So many, many die of like water and diarrhea issues. And and he's saying, so we could actually, I think he's making the point of like, we don't mind, going out of our way or either inconveniencing ourselves or giving up something that's important to us, like our new shoes or going to work or something on time, for a human life. And yet, he says, you know, he really drives it home by saying, for like the price of, you know, a bottle of water or a soda or something, that would literally save a human life, you know, according to this very rational argument, actually, right? And but we don't think that way, right? Just like the way we relate to a dog and a cow. We just take it for granted that this is how it is. And, but the argument is quite compelling, I think, that you know, there's all the arguments we could come up with that he mostly spends the book covering, all the different arguments that we would say, like, well, but that doesn't really make sense because such and such. And I'll mention some of them, but and then to make it a little bit, you know, a little bit stronger. How does he say it? He says, now think about your own situation. By donating a relatively small amount of money, you could save a child's life. Maybe it takes more than the amount needed to buy a pair of shoes. But we all spend money on things we don't really need, whether on drinks, meals out, clothing, movies, concerts, vacations, new cars, or house renovation, or Zendo renovation. Is it possible that by choosing to spend your money on such things rather than contributing to an aid agency, you're leaving a child to die, a child you could have saved? And then here's another story, because I think the stories are really powerful. So this is, he's making these up, but he also brings up some real ones, things that have happened in the news, but this one is like, this one makes it maybe harder to say what you'd do, right? Or hurts a little bit more. So Bob is close to retirement. He's invested most of his savings in a very rare and valuable old car, a Bugatti, which he has not been able to insure. The Bugatti is his pride and joy. Not only does Bob get pleasure from driving and caring for his car, he also knows that its rising market value means that he will be able to sell it and live comfortably after retirement. One day, when Bob is out for a drive, he parks the Bugatti near the end of a railway siding and goes for a walk up the track. As he does so, he sees that a runaway train, with no one aboard, is rolling down the railway track. Looking farther down the track, he sees the small figure of a child who appears to be absorbed in playing on the tracks. Oblivious to the runaway train, the child is in great danger. Bob can't stop the train, and the child's too far away to hear his warning shout, but Bob can throw a switch that will divert the train down the siding where his Bugatti is parked. If he does so, nobody will be killed, but the train will crash through the decaying barrier at the end of the siding and destroy his Bugatti. Thinking of his joy in owning the car and the financial security it represents, Bob decides not to throw the switch. This is, you know, he's making up these stories. But again, I think he asks, was he wrong? Was that like completely unethical? And I think most people would agree, but it's harder on there, right, than a pair of shoes. But again, it's this human life. And so then it's like, when you start looking at this, then why is it then? What, it doesn't really make sense. Why don't we help in this way more, he asks. And his proposal, it's interesting because he's a philosopher, so he's mainly making these philosophical arguments, but he's also very passionate because through his own reasoning, he's come to this conclusion. And so he gives a huge percent of his income to these groups like Oxfam and so on. And he's making this case in the book of, like, you know, if every, I think, I can't remember exactly, like every American, I think it is maybe, or, you know, first world country person with, you know, relatively moderate income gives like 5% of their income, which is, you know, pretty high maybe, to one of these groups. And he talks about the groups and how you have to make sure that it's being directed to actual saving and so on. But if, but that, that would be enough if everybody did that to actually eliminate this needless death through poverty, basically, and starvation around the world. And so, of course, not everybody will do that, but he's saying if a lot of people did, and then people with, who are more wealthy would give higher percentages, and he's got this whole system worked out, like taxation or something. But completely voluntary. But he's saying these are the reasons we don't, that it, like, even though it rationally makes sense, we're like, still we're like, no. No. And the reasons are the psychological factors, basically. Like, we don't see an identifiable victim. We have these two distinct mental processes for making decisions and understanding reality, according to psychologists, which are, they call affective and deliberative, or like you could say emotional and reason or rationality. And that actually emotion works very quickly. It's like intuitive, instantaneous kind of thing. So if you see the child on the track, you just do everything for that. But if you hear about, you know, 27,000 people in Africa, it's like the emotion doesn't really hit in the same way. It's more like a rational thing. Like, if we started thinking about, well, each one of those is an individual, just like the child on the track or like our own child or something. But it's, it sounds so abstract, and that's what actually prevents us from acting on it. It takes longer. You can come to the conclusion, as, you know, just reading this, it's like, that's why for me, just being open to his argument and taking it in, it's a little bit frightening because it's like, ooh, ouch, you know, like, it's just I feel like I'm kind of like, it's like opening blind eyes, a little bit like Dharma, quite a bit like Dharma in some ways. Another one is what he calls parochialism, which is like caring more about those who are close. So we say we should help the people in our country before others. And he says there's no ethical basis for that at all. You know, you could say, well, other countries' governments should take care of their countries, but actually they don't, right? And our government is taking much better care of our country than other governments are of theirs. In the sense that even what we call poverty in this country, he says, doesn't compare to people starve. Not so many people starve to death in the U.S. So it doesn't make sense rationally, but he says this thing about nearness comes from, it's an evolutionary thing, he says, which is based on people caring for their young and their families. And he says that's reasonable to take care of your family first. But that's your first responsibility. But then, you know, there's all kinds of stories and arguments about, well, should I give away, you know, all the savings that I'm saving up for my kid to have a good life to the poor in Africa? And it's all about, like, at their expense. And, you know, then his argument is more like, well, what's their expense? It's like, so they don't go to the best college or the best shoes or something. you know, again, like you can start to see how the emotion versus the rational are very different responses and this kind of thing. And other reasons are the feeling of futility, like, what can my little donation do anyway in the face of these billions of beings? And some of these organizations seem to be like, they'll actually, your dollars will actually save human beings' lives. You know? And also I think in terms of our practice, the bodhisattva spirit is kind of like in the face of futility, like our bodhisattva vows, right? Or like, beings are numberless, but I vow to save them. That's totally futile, but like, we wholeheartedly vow anyway. Another reason why we don't give is diffusion of responsibility, or it's called the bystander effect. So, and he mentions these experiments where they put a group of people in a room and they stage a fake person in distress in the next room saying, "Oh, help!" And the larger the group of people, the less likely it will be that somebody goes to help. Whereas if it's one person in the room, they usually will go help. So it's kind of like somebody else will take care of it. It's just a psychological reality that affects us. And lastly, he mentions fairness. So, well, I'll give, but like other people might not be giving as much as me, and that wouldn't be fair. So not everyone's going to give their 5%, so I'm not going to either. Just our sense of fairness. Maybe that's enough on that. You can read the book, but it's had a big effect on me. I've noticed I'm compelled to give more after reading it. And here's a story from our tradition, right, from Dogen, kind of along the same lines in this great book of Dogen stories. So Dogen says, in a kind of informal talk, he talks about Asai, who's one of his first teachers, who was the abbot at the Rinzai Monastery where he first practiced in Japan. And so once when he was the abbot, a poor man came and said, "My family is so destitute that we have had nothing to eat for several days. My wife and children are about to die of starvation. Please have compassion on us." And at that time, there was no clothing, food, or other possessions in the temple. It sounds like one of his stories, right? Although Asai contemplated what to do, he was at a loss. But there was a little bit of thin copper allocated for making the halo for the medicine Buddha, which was under construction. And so the abbot took and broke it apart and rolled it up and gave it to the poor man, telling him to exchange it for food to relieve his family's hunger. And the man was delighted and left. But then Asai's disciples reproached him, saying, "That's nothing other than the halo for the Buddha. You gave it away to that layperson. Isn't it a sin to use the Buddha's property for personal use?" And Asai says, "Yes, it is." Instead of denying it, right? Yet think of the Buddha's will. The Buddha would have given away his whole body to help living beings. So even if we gave the whole Buddha away to people who are about to die of starvation, such an action will certainly be in accordance with the Buddha's intention. And even if I fall into hell because of this sin, I have just saved living beings from starvation. So Dogen praises him for this. And then another story he tells about Asai also is, once when Asai was still alive, the temple ran completely out of food. At the time, one of the patrons invited Asai over and offered him a bolt of silk, and he rejoiced and carried it back to the temple himself instead of having someone else carry it for him. And he gave it to the temple officer who was in charge of storing things and told him to use it to pay for the next morning's breakfast and lunch. Like, at least they could have a day of eating, you know. And but then a certain layperson came and said, "A shameful affair has happened so that I need a few bolts of silk. If you have any, could you kindly let me have them?" And of course, Asai immediately took back the seal from the temple officer and gave it to the man. At that time, the officer and all the other monks were extremely upset by this. And later, Asai said, "You may think it was wrong. However, my thinking is that you gather together here because of your aspiration for the Buddha way. Like, you're going to come to practice anyway. You're not coming for food, you know. You're just coming to practice. It should not matter even if we run out of food and starve to death. It's more beneficial to save people in the secular world right now who are suffering from a lack of something they need." And Dogen says, "Truly the consideration of a person of the way is like this." So interesting, you know, it's better to save the people who aren't even practicing, right? Because like, it almost like because we're going to practice anyway, we already have bodhicitta, and we're not going to stop our practice, so we don't need much, but people who aren't practicing, we should help them because they feel like they really need something right now. So it's, again, not the way we usually think. So, embracing and sustaining living beings. Do we try to stop at 8? What time do we usually try to stop? Just a couple of questions. If there's or comments, if it'd be interesting to hear, if people think this sounds kind of extreme, or if it hits home for you, yeah.
Well, it's very moving and provocative, and you know, I think one of the things that stops me is it's like feeling ashamed that I don't do it, and so it's like that's a hurdle. Mm-hmm. You know, even if some of those things make sense, mm-hmm. then, you know, because I'm not doing it, therefore, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just that feeling of
I have that too.
The effort to actually begin mm-hmm. and to think, well, what would be the right thing and what would be the right level?
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, that whole comparative mind
yeah.
is itself an obstacle that inhibits action.
Yeah, but maybe like.
It'd be overwhelming, so like, let's try to forget about it as quick as possible.
Yeah.
I have that experience too. Yeah, because it really is, especially as a practitioner. I mean, that's what's very humbling about this is Peter Singer's like not a Dharma practitioner and with a vow to save all beings. He's just a philosopher, professor, you know. But it's the sense of like what's beneficial. So as a practitioner, I feel like, well, how, and I used to have this feeling too of, how could I not give away everything I have actually? Even to hold back anything, it's like there's some sense of shame. And I think that ties into those monastic precepts for the monks, like at this time, for these 3 years where I literally didn't have any money. That was this non-remorse thing, was totally functioned for me. It's like, I don't feel ashamed of passing homeless people when I have nothing to give them, you know. I mean, I have books and things, right, that I could, but I couldn't give them money because I didn't have any literally. And now I have a problem because I have something I can give them, and should I?
Well, yeah, because then the other side of that would be, you know, that there is nothing wrong with also caring for this one.
But again, like, if you compare, we should care for this one. We shouldn't let ourselves starve. But then that, you know, that bottle of soda, that movie, there's people dying. We could be saved from that. So is that like survival? When you start doing the comparison, if you see it as equal, if you see your life as maybe not, he actually does some percentage in here too. He says, how many, you know, how much more is your life worth than others? And he's like, you know, even if you're doing this 5% thing, it's like, you know, 50,000 times more valuable than the starving child in Africa. Even then, right? So it's like, so this, you know, it's like, yeah, we don't neglect ourselves, but it's all relative, right? Again, this is, I'm bringing this all this up to be provocative. And I'm saying it to myself,
well,
too.
It is. It is provocative, and I also appreciate you bringing it up, because this is an important
Because as practitioners, yeah, how do we deal with this? Yeah, Patrick.
Well, when I first started practicing here, I served for a while as the bookkeeper. And the rumor had it that this organization inherited this donation that we made every month to save the children. And I can't remember whether it was, we made a check each month for $4 or $16, but you know, every month I'd get the report and there would be this line item on there, you know, this money that we sent to save the children. And it was something, you know, it was something that had been inherited from, you know, boards and boards ago. Nobody remembered, as far as I can remember now. And I can remember a few board meetings where we would bring it up, not for the whole board meeting, but, you know, what are we doing with this? You know, we still want to do this? And is this where we want, you know, our charitable donations to go? Should this board do something all its own, or should we just keep saving those children? And, you know, ultimately we stopped sending a check to save the children, and, you know, our charitable giving, you know, took other forms, you know, and I think, you know, it is ultimately morphed into our support for the Global Sangha. And that too is, it's, you know, one thing we brought up was, you know, we don't even know where this money's going.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of the argument that you bring up, you know, was so far away. And it you know, it's really nice now to, you know, make soup and give it to
in front of you. Direct, yeah.
Than it is to send $4 away, you know, to who knows where.
Another argument you mentioned for people not giving to those kind of groups is money, the sense that, like, we don't feel as, like, emotionally connected with sending some money somewhere as giving a bowl of soup. So, whereas it might be actually much more effective in, like, saving a life, but it doesn't have that feeling. Yeah.
I guess the question I have is, what responsibility do we have to change the conditions that creates this suffering for people? Rather, I mean, I think part of the problem that I have with Singer's argument, as you made it, is, does that let us off the hook if we write a check? Right? And because there's a big difference between the two stories with the children in danger that you cited and, you know, the lack of adequate drugs for children in Africa, right? I mean, there's social and political conditions that have created that, which we have the power to change, where the other...
Well, what do you mean we have the power to change?
Through, you know, through political action. They're not...
Like, so, individually,
so,
though.
So poverty is not necessarily an accident of fate, whereas a child falling into a lake, you know, is, right? And so there are kind of systematic things that people can do.
But are they, as an individual, could you do something that actually saves a particular life? Not to discount making efforts to make political changes, but either, I mean, that's one question to look at, is like, can I actually personally make a difference, like, that $3 would make in terms of, like, a human suffering life? And also, are we doing those things? You know, it's like, well, like, you know, are we, you know, do I want to put that much energy, the life, the amount of energy that it takes to save a life into some political work? But, I mean, ethically, those are interesting questions. I don't know any answers. Maybe we should stop. And, but if more people have comments, we can talk at tea. Because I'm interested to... Almost like I partly bring it up because I want to be like refuted, or I want somebody to refute Peter Singer and be like, wait a second, you're like forgetting a whole something here. And I hope somebody could do it, but I don't think. I don't think it's going to be possible.
Yeah.
Especially if you read it. He does a better job than I, really convincing. So, thank you for opening your hearts and minds to a new reality. We dedicate the merit of this gathering to the complete awakening of all beings. Beings are numberless. I am